From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the GOP-controlled legislature passes a new budget that the governor declares is a mess. We look at the education budget, which Republicans declare to be the largest in state history.
But folks who study this would say that, in fact, when you account for inflation, the average district's per pupil funding has dropped by 25% over the last 15 years.
Plus the modest bump in special ed funding.
Nobody wants to shortchange our special ed students, but our general ed students are being shortchanged as a result of the lack of reimbursement.
And the homecoming for a Detroit man after 3 years in a Chinese prison.
I've been waiting for that moment. Like, I've replayed this moment in my mind millions of times.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later this hour, a West Michigan lake town prepares to celebrate a silent film legend who declared that town to be his favorite spot on Earth. But first, the pressure is on to avoid a partial state government shutdown by the October 1st deadline. State legislatures wrapped up work and approved a new $59.9 billion budget for fiscal year 2020. But now these 14 budget bills go to Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and she says they are, and I'm quoting her, a mess. Let's talk budgets and politics now with Zach Gorchow of Gongwer. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Cindy.
It's the first budget dance between the Democratic governor and the GOP-controlled legislature. And if she's calling it a mess, it seems this dance isn't going so smoothly.
Yeah, it's been a pretty fraught last month between the Democratic governor and the Republican-controlled legislature. These budget bills that have now received final votes and will be going to her desk in a matter of a day or two or three were put together without the governor's input. These were written by the Republicans with a little bit of input from the legislative Democrats, but not a ton. And the governor's reaction, once she has these bills on her desk, everyone is watching and waiting to see what she does. I don't think anybody thinks she's simply going to sign them and say, great job, everybody, let's move on.
You know, Zach, if you think about it, especially through the summer, we had the governor and the Republican leaders in the legislature each saying, yeah, I'm willing to listen to ideas. I'm willing to work with the other side. But as you say, these bills were written with zero input from the governor. So what happened?
Well, it all comes back to roads. That's been really the issue that has dominated the Capitol for some time. For a long time, the governor had been saying she would not sign a fiscal year 20 budget for the entire state government apparatus without a fundamental change in how roads are funded and an increase in how roads are funded. But the Republicans in the legislature really wouldn't budge on a major source of new revenue, aka a tax increase that the governor was looking for. And so they began saying, you know what, we just need to do the budget and we'll deal with roads later. And eventually the governor decided to concede to that she gave up on her vow not to sign a budget that lacked a long-term road funding solution. So they went to work on trying to negotiate the budget. And it fell apart quickly when the Republican leaders in the legislature, Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirky, suggested putting $500 million from the general fund into roads as a short-term measure. And the governor felt this was a bait and switch, that she had agreed to resolve the budget and pause road funding talks. And now here the Republicans were putting funding, you know, more funding in for roads as part of the budget. The governor objects to the idea of using the general fund for the budget. Historically, that's not what the general fund was for. The roads were funded by things like gas taxes and vehicle registration fees. But it's been used as a stopgap for most of the past decade. And so once that happened, the Republicans decided we're going to finish the budgets on our own.
And it seems very clear from reading your piece in Gongwer, there's no communication. I mean, you even quote Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, I don't know what to expect, and said he hadn't talked to her in a number of days.
That's right. The governor has pretty much just said, I think the way she put it to us maybe a week to 10 days ago was, they got to do what they got to do, meaning the legislature, and then I've got to do what I've got to do, meaning her and signing, vetoing, or line item vetoing these budgets. I think, you know, she's been on the sidelines with this, frustrated that the Republicans insisted on using money she thinks should go toward other programs like higher education, community colleges, K-12 schools, frustrated that money is going toward roads. And the Republicans are saying, look, roads are the number one priority. Of course we should be putting some extra funding toward that.
And so here we have less than a week until that budget deadline. We know the legislature is not scheduled to vote on anything today or tomorrow. Their staffers are printing and compiling these 14 budget bills to send to the governor. So just kind of walk us through her options.
Okay, so the first option, which I don't think is likely, is she could simply sign all the budgets and say, great job, everybody, it's all done. I think it's clear that's not going to happen. Option number two would be to veto some or all of the budget bills in their entirety. That is problematic because if she does that, with just a day or two or three left in the fiscal year, the new fiscal year starts October 1, some or all of the state departments and agencies are going to be likely into a partial government shutdown starting at midnight, September 30th. And she has made it clear, she thinks that would be a catastrophic situation. So that seems unlikely. Option number three is sign the budgets, but use her power under the Michigan Constitution to line item veto specific spending items. And this is what I think a lot of people are expecting is going to happen. What nobody knows is the degree to which she would do it. You know, she could line item veto a lot of tiny things that are kind of small potatoes, but fundamentally doesn't really alter the budgets, or she could really go after a lot of items that she thinks are, for lack of a better term, Republican pork, or others would say Republican priorities, and 86 of those from the budget, and they wouldn't be funded. And then another option she has is something that hasn't been used since John Engler did it once, which is to use a very obscure entity known as the State Administrative Board, which traditionally is used to approve large contracts for state government, but to use that to transfer funding within departments. So let's say she could sign, let's say, the Department of Health and Human Services budget, but decide, I don't like that the Republicans put $10 million toward Program A. I think that money should go toward Program Q. And she could use that State Administrative Board, which is stocked with her appointees and that she effectively controls, to do that. This is kind of a nuclear option. It amounts to the governor unilaterally moving money. It is legal. The Michigan Supreme Court upheld
lots of options are on the table, aren't they?
Yep. That's right.
Zach Gorchow-Gongwer, always great to have you. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.
He spent 3 years in a Chinese prison after a life-altering fight in a bar. Today, Detroiter Wendell Brown came home to a joyous welcome for friends and family nearly 3 years to the day after that bar fight. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman was at Detroit Metropolitan Airport for this emotional homecoming. You can hear it in those voices, Bryce. What was this airport reunion like? Who was there and what did he have to say?
Oh, it was really emotional. There were about 15 or so friends and family among the group of people there. They held up a banner saying, "Welcome home, Wendell." They were all really happy to see him, but obviously there were just tears flowing, lots of hugs and kisses. And then Wendell spoke to all of us reporters who were there. He had a few words to say.
I've been waiting for that moment. Like, I've replayed this moment in my mind millions of times over the past few years, just waiting to finally see these smiles and hear that roar of cheer. Like, it was beautiful.
Remind us again, why was Wendell Brown in China and what happened to land him in prison there?
Yeah, so Wendell, when he left Ball State, he was a football player there. He went to play in the Canadian Football League. Then he played in Austria. And then he landed a job coaching American football in China. Mm-hmm. And one night he was at a bar with some friends and a man threw some bottles at him. And Wendell allegedly pushed the man down and somehow the guy injured his eye. So he was, arrested that night, landed in jail. and the trial happened, and it took a while for him to actually get a verdict. So he had been sitting in jail for months and months and months, just waiting to hear what was going to happen to him.
And Chinese courts, basically, if you're there, you're going to get convicted, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Even
if you're,
if
you're a foreigner and you're accused of something, you're going to be in jail.
And even though he said he was trying to defend himself and he pleaded not guilty.
Exactly. And he still maintains his innocence in this situation, as do his friends who were at the scene. And the person who accused him even admitted in court later that he lied. So it's a situation that no one wants to be in. But Wendell didn't seem too harp on it. He didn't seem too mad. He was just really happy to be back with his family and to be back home.
And I know it was June of 2018 when he got a 4-year prison term, and he'd already been held for the 20 months prior to sentencing. How did he get out of prison early? Who's getting credit for that?
So the family is crediting a couple of people. They're crediting his attorney over in China, but they're also crediting some media from China. There was an American reporter who heard about the story and did everything he could to get attention to it. And when a few reporters here in the States, myself included, did stories on it, the story just kept spreading like wildfire.
And then I guess what the government did, our government got involved as well?
Yeah, and our government got involved. People at the embassy over in China got involved, and they were like, hey, we saw what happened, or we heard what happened. We heard the stories from the court hearing. And this guy doesn't seem like he did anything. Like, you guys got to let him go.
And they did early.
Yeah, they did.
So how much contact had Wendell Brown's family had with him in all those years he was in prison?
He says he mostly communicated to them through letters. He did at some points, I think a couple of times a year, FaceTime with his mom and call his mom, I think specifically after the trial and after the verdict was announced.
Now, did anyone have any hints on what he will do now that he's home? I mean, wasn't he a criminal justice major at one point?
He was. He doesn't really plan to pursue any legal action right now. He does want to speak publicly about what happened to him and his story. He hopes to help other people who have been in the same situation. He even spoke on that a little bit earlier.
Any way that I can strengthen other people, any way that I can bring positive light to someone's life, I'm open for it.
Well, before he starts bringing positive light to people's lives, what's the first thing he wants to do now that he's back home in Detroit?
Well, I know the first order of business is the Brown family is going to have a big Thanksgiving-esque meal for him. When he was in prison, he didn't get to eat much. He didn't really trust the food. So he said he's hungry and he is ready to eat.
Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More to come on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it is Wednesday, so you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with the help of our friends at the Michigan History Center.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
His face may have been one of the most famous on the silver screen, but his heart, it turns out it was in Michigan. We're talking about one of the early legends of Hollywood, silent film star Buster Keaton, and his most favorite spot on earth, Muskegon. Who better to tell us about this connection than Michigan High School Athletic Association historian and board member of the International Buster Keaton Society, Ron Pesch, back with us on Stateside. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
So older Stateside listeners, Ron, they will know about Buster Keaton, but perhaps our younger listeners, not so much. So just tell us a little about who he was and how Buster Keaton made his mark in Hollywood.
Well, he was really considered today one of the greatest film directors ever, but back in the 1920s, he was known around the world as contemporary of Charlie Chaplin's and a silent film star. He had produced a number of films in his own studio, silent comedies that were a hit.
When you talk about legends, especially from the silent era of Hollywood, Buster Keaton is right up there with Chaplin.
Absolutely. There were really three greats, and they were Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd. And they were the ones that turned lots of dollars in the box office.
And so we're talking about a man named Joseph Frank Keaton. What led him to Muskegon? How did he come to build these ties with West Michigan?
Well, Buster was actually born to a pair of vaudeville parents. They were working in medicine shows, and he was actually born in Pickway, Kansas, as the family passed through with the medicine show. As the years progressed, Buster became part of the family act. And back in vaudeville during that time, of course, they were performing in theaters across the states. But in the summertime, those theaters did not have air conditioning. So when the family traveled for performances in the summer, that usually led them to resort towns. And that brought them to Muskegon, which had a vaudeville theater right along the shores of Lake Michigan. Hmm. The family came here in 1902 and 1905 to perform there. And on one of their visits, Joe Keaton, Buster's father, noticed that it was a very nice area, and he really was hoping to settle the family down for the summers when they didn't have to perform once they became more successful, and he bought property here. That led the family to Muskegon and invited a number of his friends from vaudeville to relax for the summer along the shores here. That started the actors' colony. For the next 10 years, Buster and his siblings spent their summers in Muskegon playing in the water and running up and down dunes around the area here.
Sounds pretty lovely. And then he went to Hollywood.
Correct. The family act broke up. Buster was actually born in 1895, and by the age of 21, the family act had broken up. He set off on his own to New York, where by chance he bumped into another film star, Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. Arbuckle invited Keaton to his studio to see how things worked. Buster fell in love with it and starred in a film called The Butcher Boy with Arbuckle, and that started his film career.
So as his star rose in Hollywood, did he return to Muskegon? Was that kind of a refuge for him?
He certainly did. He did come back here on a few occasions. Once he hit Hollywood in the 20s, of course, that occupied most of his time, but he happened to bring both his second and third wives back to Muskegon to see the place that he called home.
Does Muskegon honor this legacy of being special to Buster Keaton? I know his birthday's coming up.
That's correct. He was born in October, and so what happens for the last 25 years is the International Buster Keaton Society has been coming to Muskegon to celebrate the connection between Keaton and this town. And they bring an amazing collection of people from literally around the globe. We'll have over 100 people here in about 2 weeks, October 4th and 5th and 6th, the International Buster Keaton Society will come here to celebrate their connection to Keaton. Of course, what's happened over those 25 years, we've had a Michigan Historical Marker pop up down in the Bluffton area where the Actors Colony was. Today, there's a full life-size Keaton statue in front of the Frauenthal Theater downtown Muskegon that actually came from Hollywood.
And I have to ask you about the International Buster Keaton Society and also the group. You call yourselves the Damfinos?
That's correct.
Tell us where that nickname came from.
Well, it's actually a reference to a joke in a Keaton short film called The Boat. Is built a boat that he takes his family out to sea in. They get lost at sea. He radios for help. And when asked the name of the boat by the person that received the SOS, he types in Damfino. And, of course, that leads to the joke, well, if you don't know the name of the boat, how can we rescue you? And then at the end of the film, when they finally land on shore, his wife asks him, and of course this is all in silence, where are we? And Buster mouths the words, Damfino.
What drew you, Ron, to Buster Keaton and to his body of work?
Well, as a young kid, the local television station around here started showing Harold Lloyd movies. And I thought they were great. I happened to talk about them to a family member who happened to mention that there was a silent film star that lived down along the shoreline here in Muskegon. And, you know, I asked who that was. They said, I think it might be Charlie Chaplin. I'm like, Charlie Chaplin lived in Muskegon? Well, later I found out, of course, it was Buster Keaton. I happened to see one of his films, The General, and I was hooked.
And are you seeing any kind of renewed interest in Buster Keaton and his work among younger people?
Absolutely. Thanks to the internet and the fact that back in the mid-90s, a lot of Keaton films were re-released on videotape and now, you know, Blu-ray and DVD. He's found a brand new audience. One of the amazing things to me every year with this convention that shows up is the number of young fans that happen to pop into town because they want to learn more. They're fascinated by what they see on television. Keaton was renowned as his own stuntman, and, you know, he was not afraid to put his life in danger for the entertainment of thousands. And, you know, he's got a number of people that follow him, amongst them Jackie Chan, Steven Spielberg, the folks at Pixar, all love Keaton films. And that's really introduced a new crowd to these classic 1920 films.
And again, the convention, you said, is October 4th, 5th, and 6th. So anyone looking to kind of dive into some appreciation of Buster Keaton, Muskegon is the place to be that weekend.
That's correct. And Saturday night in particular is the perfect time to be here. There's two Keaton films, The Cameraman and One Week, that are being shown at the restored Fraunthal Theater in downtown Muskegon. That's open to the public. And they're amazing to see those films as they were supposed to be seen, with an organ accompanying the action on the films and with a live audience that gets caught up in the story, and the laughter is contagious, of course.
Michigan High School Athletic Association historian and also board member of the International Buster Keaton Society's The Damn Finos. Ron, thanks for sharing Buster Keaton's Muskegon connection with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The constant barrage of news about climate change, drinking water contamination, pollution in the Great Lakes, it can all feel overwhelming. If you care, it's hard to know what to do or where to start. And that's where Stateside's new series comes in. We're featuring ordinary people who identified a problem, no matter how big or small, and then chose to act. These are the people in your neighborhood working to make Michigan a greener place. We're calling them the Climate Crew.
Climate change is the defining issue of our time.
You look at older generations and you think to yourself, why didn't you do anything?
I mean, you have to act.
Our children's future is at stake and we have to make changes.
Continuing our spotlight on the ways people in Michigan are responding to climate change and environmental challenges, we turn now to Logan Veer. She's a University of Michigan senior who's studying environmental engineering and programming in the environment. And she is the only undergraduate student who was chosen to sit on the university's Commission on Carbon Neutrality. Logan Veer, welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Well, you are the founder of the Climate Action Movement in Michigan. Just what is that and what has it done?
Yeah, so I'm one of the co-founders, actually. So there's been a large group that's been working on this for about a year and a half, almost 2 years now. And basically, the Climate Action Movement is a coalition of students, of faculty, of community members in Ann Arbor, any stakeholders within the University of Michigan. And we essentially work to pressure the university to enact all of these different changes that need to be happening to get to carbon neutrality and to really enforce climate action on campus, as well as in the greater Washtenaw County community. So it's really does a lot of work with direct action, as well as just talking with the administration directly, and kind of a mix of all of the different ways in which we can pressure to make our administration move forward.
And I know there have been some very visible activities. Do you feel like the administration is hearing you?
I definitely do, yes. Over this past year, there was a lot of progress that we saw, which was really exciting. We basically started because we realized that the university had set goals in 2011 to get to 25% reductions for their carbon and greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. And about a year ago, they were only at about 5%. So a lot of time had passed already and little progress had been actually made. So we realized that and we knew that something needed to change. And so we started attending the Regents meetings and we started talking with the administration. And by beginning of last school year, they were actually starting to hear us. I was at one of the very first Regents meetings in September, and 2 weeks later was when President Schlissel made his announcement that there was going to be a commission made
yes.
and progress moving forward.
So here you are. You sit yes. on this commission. It's President Mark Schlissel's Commission on Carbon Neutrality. You are an organizer. You are an advocate. But you told the Michigan Daily that you don't see yourself as an environmental activist.
I think it's a work in progress. I said that not out of not necessarily thinking that I am not wholly an activist. I work within all different realms, and I am starting to, I think, more embody that term and that title. But for a while, I was really just, it was something that I felt like I had a responsibility to do, and it was more of something that I saw as a student. I felt that this was a really good way in which I could kind of leverage my position to get the university to move forward, because students really are the voice of the university. And once I kind of realized that, I have started to become, I think, a little bit more okay with the term activist. But before, it was really I wanted to just support and move forward and do research. But now I definitely do feel more of an activist. And
I want to go back even earlier. And I know you changed from pre-med
yes.
to environmental engineering. I'm interested in what got you off the couch and aware when you first became aware of threats to the environment to the point where you've responded with action.
Yeah. The biggest thing for me was a course that I took at Michigan. And there were a lot of kind of small different realizations that I came to along the way, whether that was just, like I said, the lack of progress that the university was making, and also just the need for renewable energy and just small things like that that I just hadn't really realized. I knew that climate change obviously was happening, but I wasn't super attuned to all of the needs of it. And then I realized how intersectional it was. And that's what really pushed me forward.
So you get more and more active. What motivates you? You've been involved with the climate strike sit-in at Michigan, the rally, the march, all of that. So it reminds me of the kind of activism that we saw on this campus in the 60s related to the Vietnam War.
That's actually a perfect segue, because that's basically what does motivate me, I think, is all of the different movements that have come before us that are either continuing on today or have made huge progress within social justice. And I really see environmental justice and climate justice as a way to intertwine all of those and move forward, not only for the environment itself, but for all social justice issues across the board, because they're all related. And climate justice is really one way in which we can spearhead that, I think.
You're sitting on the President's Commission on Carbon Neutrality, so you have President Schlissel's ear as part of that. What kinds of changes do you want to see the University of Michigan enact to really set an example for other schools and other institutions?
I think one of the biggest things is being clear that the systems that we currently have are not working. I think that's the first step, is really just acknowledging that we need to make changes. And they've done that in a variety of different ways, but I think a clear statement like that is huge. And then furthermore, really making an ambitious goal and setting a goal, whether that's 2030, as we have been advocating for, or something within that realm, it needs to be soon, and it needs to be something that holds the university accountable.
And what is the goal then, 2030? What do you want?
Yeah, carbon neutrality by 2030 okay. is the goal.
Okay. Now, individual actions can certainly help to protect and help the environment and help reduce one's carbon footprint. What of our elected leaders? How do you think we should go about demanding substantive action from the policymakers, the decision makers, the people we elect, and hold them accountable?
I think it all starts with the conversations, and I think it's really being open and being clear in all of our asks that we want to be working together. And I think moving forward, a lot of the strikes that are going on, I think they can kind of feel very abrasive at some points, but that's not the goal. And we want to make sure that that's clear, that it's not the goal. It's yes, making the statement that we need to be moving and we need to be moving quickly, but it's also the statement that we are here to help and we want to be a part of this movement forward of really solving this global crisis.
Do you reach out to elected leaders?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's obviously huge as well. It's just reaching out, like I said, having the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's within these big statements and these big actions, but also small things like contacting your elected officials, sending emails, making phone calls, anything like that.
You're a senior. What are your plans after this year?
That's a really good question that I don't necessarily know the answer to quite yet. But hopefully something where I can continue to do environmental activism work, organizing work.
Logan Veer, the only undergraduate student who's sitting on the University of Michigan President's Commission on Carbon Neutrality. Logan, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
We know there are many others like Logan Veer out there. We just don't know about them. So we need your help. If you know of anyone working to make their part of Michigan a greener place, please let us know. To nominate someone, send us an email with helpful information to stateside@michiganradio.org and be sure to put Climate Crew in the subject line. That's stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, on paper, the proposed state budget for education looks like it's getting a big increase. But what does a closer examination tell us? Well, we'll dive in after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Among the 14 budget bills passed by the legislature Tuesday was a more than $15 billion education budget for fiscal year 2020. So let's break that down now with Chalkbeat Detroit's Kobe Levin. The GOP is celebrating this $15.2 billion school budget, tweeting it provides record funding per pupil and more money for lowest funding districts than the governor's plan and without a tax hike. So does that claim hold up under close examination?
So on the face of it, the budget has increased slightly every year for a number of years now. But folks who study this would say that, in fact, when you account for inflation, the average district's per pupil funding has dropped by 25% over the last 15 years.
So that is a bite. And certainly the Democrats are pointing out that inflation factor, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. You saw some pretty amusing jabs from some Democratic lawmakers over the last weeks. They say that, you know, economists all account for inflation. It's a basic thing that we do when we're looking at financial data over time. But the Republican talking points sometimes don't take that into account.
So last year, a bipartisan group of education experts called for a different way for the state to fund our schools. And among the recommendations was another $3 billion a year. So how does this new budget compare to that?
So this falls far short of that, and even Governor Whitmer's education budget proposal wouldn't have come close. That would take, you know, a major overhaul, and it never seemed likely, it has to be said, in a year when everyone's focused on fixing the roads. So it is just a very incremental step in that direction. Just as important, though, to that number, the several billion dollars that some folks say it would take to really shape things up in the Michigan education landscape, is how they want to do that. And that's where you're seeing some key differences between Whitmer's proposal and the legislature's.
Yes, explain that to us.
So a lot of education experts are starting to agree in Michigan on this basic principle that some students are more expensive to educate than others. We're talking about special education students, students whose first language isn't English. It just takes more staff, more time to give those folks an adequate education. So what some have called for is sending additional money to schools that enroll more students like that, more expensive students. And Governor Whitmer's budget proposal did take a step in that direction towards what's called a weighted funding formula with more weight placed on those more needy students. And the Republican budget rejects that idea. It maintains the current formula.
Okay. So she did not get the weighted funded formula. And she also, speaking of special ed, she asked for a 4% boost for special ed. What did the legislature deliver in its budget?
So it's quite a bit less than that. There is a $60 million boost, which is about 2%. It's important to note, though, that Michigan is still taking most of its money for special education out of the money that would otherwise go to regular education classrooms. So this means that we're taking less out of the pot for the rest of students, not necessarily that special education students are getting more overall.
Fair enough. So when you look at the bottom line, the governor had hoped to raise new revenue for the budget by boosting our state's gasoline tax by 45 cents. Republicans said,
right.
Nah, that didn't happen. And they opted for this small increase in school funding, but no tax. So how are we paying for it?
So a good chunk of the funding for the Republican education budget comes from money that was going to higher education. So basically, it's a transfer of some $150 million from the higher education budget over to K-12. The higher education budget is going to stay roughly flat. That's because they're taking interns, another $150 million or so, from the general fund, which is the pot of money that's used for things like the PRISM system and foster care and public safety. So, you know, a lot of money moving around here. What we're not seeing, as you mentioned, is new revenue, which is what the governor's proposal really relied on.
It kind of reminds me of my mother was a farm girl, and she used to talk about borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
That's about it.
This year's budget also is different than previous years, where the education budget is separate from the rest of the general state budget. So what happens if the governor, who's she's decried this and said it's a mess, what if she vetoes the state's general budget? What might happen to education?
So it's going to take a piecemeal approach here. The governor can reject the state overall budget and still pass the education budget. She could veto pieces of any of those budgets. That drama is playing out right now. As you mentioned, the governor is at loggerheads with the state legislature. So we'll just have to see what she decides to do. But she can basically pick and choose, reject whatever portions of the Senate's budget, and rather the legislature's budget that she'd like, and let the rest go through.
Looks like we'll be talking again. Kobe Levin, Chalkbeat Detroit. Thanks, Kobe.
Thanks for having me.
Now let's zoom in on a specific part of the K-12 budget, special education. Districts are required by state and federal law to provide certain special education services, but the state's reimbursement for those services falls short of what it actually costs to provide them. And as we just heard, the K-12 budget passed by the state legislature falls short of what the governor wants, especially in the area of special education. So here to talk about what this means for schools around the state is Ron Kaler, who's assistant superintendent for the Kent County Intermediate School District. Ron, districts right now are having to spend money and funds from their overall budget to cover these mandated special education services. So how big a gap is there between what you're spending and what the state is paying for?
Cynthia, 3 years ago, Michigan's Lieutenant Governor at the time, Lieutenant Governor Calley, conducted a study of that very issue, and they found a shortfall of $692 million statewide in the cost for special ed services and the reimbursements that our local districts received. At that time, that amount was about $700 per pupil, meaning that $700 per pupil that could have gone to general education students were instead going to special education students as a result of the lack of reimbursement for mandatory services as required by law.
So that was 3 years ago, and the $692 million is a big hit.
Yes.
Governor Whitmer asked for $120 million in special ed funding. The legislature gave her $60 million. Is that additional funding going to be enough to cover what districts are spending on services?
It will not be enough, but let me tell you, it's appreciated. It's appreciated that we have a governor who recognizes that shortfall, and it's appreciated that now the legislature is beginning to recognize that shortfall, because those dollars, as we know, need to be directed toward the services that all students need. And nobody wants to shortchange our special ed students, but our general ed students are being shortchanged as a result of the lack of reimbursement for those services.
So for districts like yours, for Kent County, how much of a difference will this funding boost in the new budget from the state make for you?
Right now, our districts are subsidizing special education by approximately $300 per pupil in this school year. With the additional $60 million proposed for the 2019-2020 budget, that would be about $35 a pupil. So that would reduce that shortfall to $265 per pupil.
So when you think about the impact on students, who's going to be hit harder by that, special ed students or those in general education?
Special education students, their services are mandated by law. Michigan is one of the most generous states in the nation, if not the most, providing services from birth through age 26. Every other state is through age 21. They will receive the services they deserve. What we are saying is that the failure to completely reimburse then denies certain services or opportunities to the remainder of the student body.
What kind of services will be lost to the student body? Give us a for instance.
I must say that this hits each county differently because every county, every ISD like ours, levies a special education millage. And based on the SEV in those counties, it's a different number. In neighboring Muskegon to us, for example, this year their shortfall is $800 per pupil. But in Ottawa County, because of their very valuable property along the lakeshore, their shortfall is only $140 per pupil. So it hits everybody a little bit differently. But here's an example. Michigan is 47th in the nation in counselors per student. The national recommendations are each counselor should have a caseload of about 250 pupils. In Michigan, it's closer to 750 pupils per counselor. So all of our students are losing direct services and counseling because of these shortfalls that are not being reimbursed.
These shortfalls, is this sustainable, Ron?
I think if you were to look at the research, if you were to look at the research of the School Finance Research Collaborative, if you were to look at the research of Dr. David Arson of Michigan State University, you'll find that Michigan has, in terms of new investment in schools, is 50th in the nation out of 50 states since 1995. You will also find that as a result, our student performance on national assessments has declined dramatically. I'm sure you've done stories about our third grade reading or other data demonstrating that our students are lagging the nation. It's this lack of investment and the inability of schools to provide the reading experts, the counselors, the social workers, the school nurses, and other services that are evident in other states that we cannot afford as a result of this failure to adequately invest in our schools.
Ron Kaler is Assistant Superintendent for the Kent County Intermediate School District. Ron, thank you so much.
And thank you for this opportunity. We appreciate it.
After school and extracurricular activities, sports teams, hobby groups, drama programs, school clubs, all of these are more than a way for kids to fill the hours outside of school. A lot of educators believe the skills kids learn in extracurricular activities are just as important as test scores in predicting future success. Yet, not all students have equal access to these extracurriculars. There is a definite gap in access to after-school programs. Here to talk about that is Michigan Radio's education commentator, Matinga Ragatz. Matinga, just how much do school and after-school and out-of-school programs matter to academic performance?
Well, it all depends. Some programs are a lot more intentional about bringing academic concepts in them. So I talked to Dustin Hunt from Muralmatics, and he combines math and art concepts. And this is what he had to say.
So I had to change gears as an art teacher to figure out how to teach math. And so Muralmatics is a combination of teaching math concepts while doing large-scale murals. So in the end, students have something to show for it. And along the way, they picked up different math concepts.
What Dustin said is so incredible because, remember, the extracurricular activities, and even in college, that's what ends up in your resume. Like your Geometry 205 class does not appear in your resume. So the idea that he's taking an academic content and putting it in something the kids can show, it's incredible.
Are there things after school programs give the students that they can't get out of that time in the classroom?
Sure there are. And you have to be careful with after school programs. There's a tendency to overschedule the kids' after school activities. And often these kids, and there's tons of research that shows that these kids, it really plays with their attention span. And it actually impedes their academic performance. But on the other hand, there are so many things that these enrichment programs can provide for students that they cannot get in class. For example, there are places where these kids can get mentorship opportunities that used to be provided in the schools. And oftentimes, teachers just cannot put the pencils down and take advantage of these teachable moments. And in school, also, there's a tendency to quantify every single event, and we have to assess every activity. And so it makes it really, really hard for kids to just kind of do like a self-expression, get messy and not care about, you know, the consequences. They're more likely to just kind of showcase what they can do.
And then certainly there's those intangible life lessons you learn from being, let's say, part of a sports team, or let's say competing in track or cross country, or being in a drama program, when you really learn a lot about yourself.
For sure. And then in some of these activities and some of these programs, there is no competition. It's just all about you and yourself and your own life journey.
So what are barriers for families or for kids in getting involved in all of these kinds of out of school activities? Who's being shut out and why?
Well, there are many, many barriers. But one of the big barriers is that in the traditional after school programs, some kids just don't fit in. So I talked to Ose Moore. He is the founder of All of the Above Hip Hop Academy. And this is what he had to say about the students that come to his joint.
A few kids actually really like connect in a way, because it's maybe they're not the athlete, or maybe, you know, they're not in drama, or they're not in these traditional after school activities. But they do write rhymes and they do make beats at home.
And he went on to say that, you know, some of these kids love performing, but not necessarily in a theater. And these kids like to compete, but not necessarily in the field. So it's a really interesting point of view for kids who otherwise would not have these activities.
So how do you address the barriers keeping kids out of these activities? What's happening around Michigan that's finding new ways to involve all kids in extracurriculars?
Well, I think this is what's really cool, because, you know, cost is prohibitive sometimes, and distance. Like in Michigan, we don't have a very fluid public transportation system. So it's hard for kids who cannot drive to get around. But what's really cool is that community members, like, and I'm not talking about volunteering after school in your kids' activity or in the place of worship, but community members who are creating organizations to fill these gaps. And often these organizations are located right in the community. It's cheaper, it's more accessible to everybody. For example, I spoke to Alice Brinkman, and she does an organization called Reach Art Studio Center, where kids can come and just kind of play with art. And she talked to me about how important it was, like her organization had become to her community, and how the community now is so invested in the success of of her program that they are basically driving her program, which is absolutely magical.
When you think of the fact that, for example, costs of being part of sports or other programs have to be imposed because school budgets are short, so costs are up. Some kids don't relate, as you pointed out, to maybe an athletic approach. Are there lessons that schools and teachers can take away from how some of these after-school programs you've explored are being run?
Oh, for sure. And sometimes when we are trying to cut off a program to save the money, we end up cutting off the wrong end. And there are some life lessons that cannot be manifested in the curriculum. And I would emphasize to the schools that, you know, not every activity needs to be assessed, and not every hour of the day needs to be accounted for academically. I think when the students want to be in a learning space, they are just going to learn more. And more importantly, I think when speaking of all of these community educators, is that when teachers are allowed to teach within their passion and what they are really good at, their learning environments become so powerful and so inspirational and unbelievably unforgettable.
Michigan Radio's education commentator, Matenga Ragatz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Be here tomorrow when we check in on the UAW strike at General Motors well into its second week. And we'll meet a ninth grader from Detroit who's getting ready for the World Youth Chess Championship in Mumbai, India. You'll hear that and much more tomorrow on Stateside. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.